You said I had a choice. You do. It doesn't feel that way. That's because you've always had difficulty disobeying me. Is that a bad thing? Maybe. I don't know. I know much, but not everything. I don't know how this will end. I don't know whether what you do will change anything. But I hope it will. Now I must go. This time it is forever, I think. A pang of guilt hit Bear in the chest as he realized he felt only relief, closure. Henry?
Yes, Mother.
I love you. I always will.
I love you too, Mother.
Goodbye.
Wait!
I'm here.
I'll do it. I'll go to Castle Hill. I'll seek my fate.
I know. Goodbye, Henry.
Goodbye, Mother.
His last two words fell on deaf ears, because she was already gone. This time he knew it was forever. 115 years later, circa 500. Bear had lived too long. He'd given up on making friends, because they always died in the end. He did, however, continue raising wolfhounds from pup to maturity. Watching them pass on was tough, too, but he handled it in his own way. Although more than a century ago he'd planned to travel directly from Walburg to Castle Hill, that's not what happened. No, his instincts had set a different path under his feet, one that led him westward, back to the land of his childhood. All these years had passed, and still he hadn't hidden his mother's prophecies, their aged, crinkled pages beginning to fade. So he'd done two things. First, he picked out the lines of text that seemed the most important, the true prophecies. He inked those on his own skin permanently.
Now they can never be lost, so long as I am alive, he'd thought.
Second, he hid the original copies in two places. The Dead Isles, an uninhabited island off the western coast, and Citadel, Calypso's City of Scholars. Instinct had guided him to these two locations. From there he'd headed back north, trudging over the mournful mountains to avoid the border fighting at Raiders Pass. Then he turned eastward to Darin, where he'd once again avoided the fighting by providing fresh meat for the army. He lived a life there, and then departed, heading back west, from shore to shore, all the way to Blackstone, where a naval battle with the West had broken out. He was no seaman, and no one tried to recruit him, despite his size. The war for the Four Kingdoms had stretched over a century, with no evidence of ending any time soon, and was now being called the Hundred Years' War. Tales of the marked warriors from each kingdom doing battle continued to swirl through pubs and markets, until it was all anyone seemed to talk about. Many of them had been killed, but were quickly replaced by new marked births. The only exception remained the West, where any marked children were slaughtered as soon as they were discovered. Bear kept his list, updating for those born, those killed. For what purpose, he knew not, but it felt better keeping track. He stayed in Blackstone, biding his time, until his lack of aging became a problem once more.
"Why am I here, Mother?" he wondered. "What is my fate? Where is the peace you prophesied about?"
He waited and waited and waited. And waited. Finally, in the year 482, an inner sense told him it was time, and he turned toward Castle Hill at long last. The undefeated king, Wilhelm Gerrick, and his wife, Queen Ida, had just given birth to their second child, a son, Wulfric, who was now the crown prince. Bear knew what he had to do, though he didn't know why. 18 years passed slowly, with Bear gradually making his prowess as a hunter known to the stewards of the royal kitchens, until they offered him a position as castle huntsman, replacing an aging man who was struggling to keep up with meat quotas. More fate-marked were born, though hardly anyone used that term any more. Most called them skin-marked, while in the West they were the sin-marked, no better than demons. In the South, however, they referred to the marking as Tatuya. 3 years earlier, in Fanes, Emperor Jin Hoser had a son born to him, his first. The babe, named Vin, was marked with a chain around his neck. No one knew what power it would give him, but the royal marked birth sent tremors of fear across the four kingdoms. In the east, a man bearing the iron mark, Bjorn Stonesledge, was single-handedly devastating Calypsian armies along the border of the Skara Desert. The north had one of the skin-marked, too, a tall, narrow-eyed man, known as simply the Ice Lord. Though the king himself was lauded for his skill in battle, most knew that the Ice Lord was the real reason for his success in protecting the northern borders. Hardly anyone spoke of the Western Oracle anymore, her legend fading into a past that was no longer relevant.
"She foretold all of this,"
Bear thought, as he approached the hunting lodge provided to him by the throne.
"And she foretold what comes next, too. Yet no one cares. Their ignorance will be their downfall."
His latest companion, a beautiful snow-white wolfhound named Serenaya, after his mother, though he called her Naya most of the time, trotted beside him. Years ago he'd given up the practice of naming each dog Sir. They were so much more than replacement companions to him, after all. They were his best friends, his confidants, the only ones who truly knew him. He opened the thick wooden door, sucking in a quick breath of air when he realized his cabin was occupied by another. He shook his head, laughing slightly.
"To what do I owe the pleasure, Princess Zelda?" he said.
The square-faced girl squinted at him.
"Father says I have a gloomy disposition."
Though the only daughter to the king was only 8 name-days old, she was already broad of shoulder and thick of limb. She was also slightly odd, and yet Bear tended to look forward to her regular visits. Before Bear could respond, Naya, tail wagging furiously, sprinted up to the princess and jumped up on her, licking at her arm. Zelda scratched her behind her left ear, her favourite spot. Bear said,
"Gloomy? I wouldn't say you're gloomy, exactly. More like somber, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. Regardless, you tend to cheer me up when you come around."
"Really?"
Zelda sat on Bear's bed, patting Naya when she jumped up beside her. The princess picked up a hatchet, playing with it in her lap, one of Bear's older ones that he rarely used anymore.
"Would I lie to you?"
Bear stamped the snow off his boots and then slipped them off, leaving them outside. He closed the door behind him.
"Everyone lies," Zelda said matter-of-factly.
She ran her finger along the blade, which was too dull to cut much of anything anymore. Bear couldn't deny it. So much of his life was a lie.
"Frozen hell. No one even knows my real name."
He changed the subject.
"Where are your brothers?"
He hoped, far away. Both princes had a mean streak a kingdom-wide. Lately, the crown prince, Wulfric, had taken to growling at Naya, laughing when she flinched back. Unlike many of Bear's previous wolfhounds, Naya was a gentle soul, though even she had limits.
"The crown prince," Bear mused internally.
The truth was, Wulfric was only heir to the throne because his eldest brother, Helmuth, had been born maimed, one of his legs practically useless. His nickname had swiftly become the Maimed Prince. 5 years ago, the king had finally made the decision to skip over Helmuth in the line of succession. A year after that, Helmuth had run away. The rumour was he'd left a note behind, promising to return to get his vengeance one day. He hadn't been heard from since, 4 long years later.
"Don't know, don't care," Zelda said.
Bear chuckled, which made the girl frown.
"It wasn't a jape. My brothers can get stuck in a snowdrift for all I care. They are buffoons at the least, and village fools at the most."
Trying not to laugh, Bear placed his hunting satchel on a table and lit the hearth.
"Would you like some tea?"
"Tea tastes like snake piss," she said without blinking.
"Though Mother once told me you could read the tea leaves after you finish drinking, and they'll tell you your future."
"We could try it if you want."
"But then I'd have to drink the tea," Zelda said.
"Not worth it?"
Zelda shook her head. She held the hatchet over her shoulder with one hand, pulling it back. Then, before Bear could stop her, she flung it at the door.
"What are you—" Thump!
Bear twisted his head to look. The hatchet, despite its dull edge, was stuck firmly in the wood. Wait. No. It was stuck in the direct center of a dark brown knot in the wood. Bear's eyes widened in amazement.
"Were you aiming for that?" he asked.
Naya barked in appreciation. Zelda shrugged. "I'm good at throwing things. I hit Wolfric with an ice ball from 100 paces away yesterday. You should have seen his face, all red and angry." She laughed. "He stomped around looking to see who had thrown it, but I was already hidden. What a buffoon!" Bear didn't know what to make of her, except that she was so different to her elder siblings.
"Where did you come from, princess?" Bear wondered.
"Well, just be careful what you throw. Don't hit anyone. Other than your brothers, of course."
He offered a wink, which made her laugh even more. Naya leapt to the floor, barking her head off. A moment later, fists pounded on the door.
"Open up, you mongrel!"
An angry-sounding voice hollered through the wood.
"Ugh," Zelda said. "Speak of the village, idiot."
It was Wulfric's voice.
"How much of our conversation did he hear? By the anger in his voice, all of it," Bear thought.
He opened the door. The Crown Prince glared at him, his brown eyes as icy as morning snowfall.
"Morning, Prince Wulfric. To what do I owe this unexpected visit?"
He tried to keep his voice even, rather unsuccessfully. The 18-year-old brushed a strand of long, dark hair away from his face.
"I'm looking for my sister. Stand aside."
Bear barred the entrance. Behind him, a low growl rumbled from Naya's throat.
"This is my home. I decide who enters."
"Provided by my father."
"Correct. So if your father would like to come in, he may do so. You'll require my permission."
Somewhere inside, Zelda snorted out a laugh. Wulfric gritted his teeth.
"Stand aside, or I will make you, and take pleasure in the act."
"Is that so?"
Bear widened his stance, rising up to his full height.
"Am I supposed to be scared?"
Naya's growl grew louder.
"No, you're supposed to be smart. Never fight someone twice your size."
"He's not smart," Zelda said from inside. "Come out, you little urchin,"
Wulfric said.
"Maybe later," Zelda said.
Wulfric bit the side of his lip, contemplating his options. To Bear's surprise, the prince ducked his head and charged, smashing his shoulders and head into Bear's midsection. Bear released a breath, taking a step back. But that was as far as the prince was able to push him. Before he could peel Wulfric's arms off of him, however, Naya sprang forward through his legs, unleashing a snarl and a flurry of snapping jaws. The prince cried out, falling back under the onslaught. Naya's head shook back and forth as she bit at his arm.
"Naya, release!"
Bear commanded. Grudgingly, the wolfhound let go, backing away, but not all the way inside. She stood at the threshold, guarding it, her hackles up. Wulfric, his face as white as the frozen lake, stared at his arm. Blood seeped through his shirt sleeve.
"She bit me! The bitch bit me!"
"You threatened her home," Bear said,
but he could feel the emptiness in his words, the hollowness. He knew what would come next. The prince scrambled to his feet, gripping his bleeding arm with his other hand.
"Father will hear of this," he said. "I could have been maimed, like my fool of a brother Helmuth."
Bear said nothing. There was nothing to say. The deed was already done, the consequences etched in stone. You didn't injure an heir to a kingdom and walk away unscathed. He watched the prince go and then stepped inside, beckoning Naya to follow. He closed the door. Zelda had left a while ago, telling him she would speak to her father. She would be a witness to what had happened. She would fix things. Bear had learned long ago, when his mother was in prison, that you couldn't fix the unfixable. And this was unfixable. He considered running, leaving the cabin behind and fleeing into the wilderness. He could return in the future, once everything had blown over. Naya would be safe. Something stayed him, however. Something more important than his life or his wolfhounds. The same something that had guided him for the last century and a half of his extraordinarily long life. So instead he cradled Naya's head in his arms and scratched her behind her left ear. She groaned appreciatively, not understanding why she was getting so much affection. A while later a knock came at the door, echoing through the cabin with a finality that made Bear's heart sink into his abdomen. Naya was already on the floor, growling. Back on guard duty, like the faithful pup that she was. Bear walked over and opened the door a crack. The king looked back at him, his face weary and sad. Wulfric was behind him, wearing a sneer on his face and a thick bandage on his arm. Zelda was notably absent, though there were several soldiers in full armour.
"Bear Blackboots," the king said. "You are a faithful servant to the crown, and this doesn't change that. If you will stay on in your position, we will gladly have you."
"I will," Bear said.
The king nodded thoughtfully. The sadness in his eyes, however, remained.
"But we must take your dog. I'm sorry."
Bear pursed his lips, breathing deeply through his nose.
"I understand," he said. "I hate it. But I understand the position she's put you in."
He didn't look at the prince, whose eyes were surely gleaming with victory.
"Zelda argued well for the hound," the king said. "It's the first time she's seemed to care about anything in a long time. Other than antagonizing her brothers, that is." "I'll be sure to thank her," Bear said. "It's time."
Bear opened the door wider and stepped back into the warmth. Naya's head was cocked to the side, her teeth no longer bared. Bear picked her up, carried her outside. Instead of growling, she whined when she saw Wulfric.
"Not so tough now, are you, bitch?" he said.
"Son," the king said. "That will be enough of that."
Chastened, the prince clamped his mouth shut, though the sneer remained. The king turned back to Bear.
"It's your dog. You can choose the manner of death."
"Father, I want to do—"
The prince's words fell off a cliff as the king shot him a sharp look.
"I will do it," Bear said. "You are a man of honour," the king said.
Bear didn't know about that. All he knew was that it didn't feel right for anyone else to be involved. He knelt down in the snow, holding Naya close to his chest. Just like with his mother, he felt helpless, alone. But he wasn't that boy anymore. No, he'd grown up years ago. He drew his sharpest knife from its scabbard, simultaneously stroking his dog's back. When it was over, Bear sat in the snow for a long time, until the king, his son, and the soldiers had departed, just holding her, kissing the top of her head. His tears froze on his cheeks and in his beard, but he didn't feel their chill. He would never forget what the prince had done. Never. 18 years later. A knock on his door woke him from a deep slumber. It was winter, after all, and Bear tended to be groggier this time of year. He stretched and yawned, shaking away the cobwebs. His cabin was cold and empty. After Naya's death, he'd decided not to get another dog. It was safer that way. Another knock, more insistent this time.
"Coming," he grumbled.
It was still dark outside, enormous snowflakes falling in sheets, piling up around the windows. Who would be calling at such a time? Just before he reached the door, he stopped, as if he'd been frozen in place by the Ice Lord himself. A tremor ran through him from scalp to toes, though he wasn't cold. The voice came a moment later.
"Your time begins," his mother said.
I,
he stuttered, but she was already gone. He flung open the door just as a fist tried to pound on it once more, catching him in the jaw.
"Oops," Zelda said.
"Sorry."
She was a lady now, and though her visits had become less frequent since her father's death and her brother's coronation, Bear still looked forward to them. But tonight something was different. He could tell that much from her expression, which was unusually harried and flustered, even for her. And she carried something in the crook of her arm, wrapped in a black blanket. It looked to be about the size and shape of a baby. The truth was revealed when she peeled back the corner of the blanket. A pale face stared out at him, his lips sealed tight. Bear didn't have much experience with babies, but weren't they supposed to cry? The way the boy was staring at him seemed unusual. And why would Zelda have a baby anyway? She wasn't even preg— Wait. Frozen hell, can it be? It was the Queen, Sabria Loren Garrick, who was pregnant. She was supposed to be due any day now. The Prince, he murmured in awe. What have you done?
The Queen has a favour, Zelda said.
What favour?
He glanced at the baby once more.
Those eyes. Something's not right about them.
Travel to the Mournful Mountains. There is a cave there. The directions are in a scroll I will provide. This child will be waiting for you.
I don't understand.
Protect him. Raise him. And eventually, unleash him on the world. On his father.
Bear shook his head. After all these years, everything was moving so fast. Why would the Queen do this? And why this child, and not the other two?
The Queen had already provided two heirs. A niece, now four, and Archer, who had recently reached his second name day. She believes in a prophecy, and this child is marked, while the other two were not.
Marked? Oh, Roth, it's happening at last. The Western Oracle, he whispered.
Zelda's eyes narrowed.
You know of her?
Most have forgotten, and those that haven't believe her to be fiction.
Yes, I know of her.
How?
She was my mother.
A sharp intake of breath whistled between Zelda's lips. She didn't even question how old that would make Bear. She instantly believed him.
This is no coincidence, she said instead. No,
Bear agreed. He gestured to the child, who was now sleeping.
Do you know his name?
Zelda nodded, her eyes alight with fire.
He is Bane, and one day he shall kill the king.
Suddenly, like lightning flashing in the dark of his mind, Bear knew what role he had to play in the fate of the Four Kingdoms.
It shall be done, he thought. May I burn in the first heaven, if I have chosen wrongly.
Postlude 2. The Beggar. The Southern Kingdom, Calypso. Circa 522.
Mama!
The boy screamed, thrashing about in his bed. The darkness seemed to swirl around him like a dust storm, forcing its way into his eyes, his mouth, his nose, choking him, stealing his air. The images he saw, memories, but not real memories, sent shockwaves of fear through him. A woman, her eyes dark, her sweaty hair darker, like a waterfall of wet silk, touching her baby for the first time. The beautiful smile on her brown-skinned face, the unconditional love in her expression, and the horror that flashed as blood-red boils began bursting from her flesh. She collapsed back, scratching at her cheeks, her arms, her neck. In the boy's mind, the woman died, as she did every night. Over and over and over again, only to be reborn a night later to the same fate. The boy thrashed, trying to escape the nest of tangled sheets that suddenly felt like a prison. Thump. He hit the floor in a convoluted mess of blankets and thick clothing. The impact helped vanquish the memories. He thought he'd hit his head, though he wasn't sure exactly. Slowly, slowly, his breathing returned to normal, his heartbeat slowing. Sweat trickled down his spine. In fact, it trickled everywhere. His body was sheathed in sweat, as it always was. Living under the hot Calypsian sun was part of his curse, the 8-year-old boy felt. Right now, he felt like he was being cooked alive, and he longed to peel off his thick gloves, his long socks, the mask he wore. Every bit of his body was covered, save for his eyes and mouth. It was a necessary precaution, he knew, given his condition.
He squinted as a bright light approached, bobbing in the darkness.
"Get off the floor, boy,"
a stern woman's voice said.
"Get back in bed."
The lantern stopped, illuminating the dark, crinkled face and greying hair of his guardian, a fiery woman who used words like weapons.
"I can't sleep," the boy said.
Back then he was known as Chavos, though the stern woman usually referred to him simply as Boy.
"I had a nightmare."
"You are the nightmare,"
the woman growled. Her words stung because they were the truth. Chavos was the baby in his darkest dreams, a killer, dangerous.
"I killed my own mother."
Sometimes he wished it were he who had died instead.
"Why don't you leave me, then?"
Chavos said, each word quivering like a lonely leaf blasted by a stiff wind. His bottom lip trembled. Tears pricked at his eyes.
"Because you're family," she said, "and family doesn't leave. I loved my sister very much. I'm doing this for her, not you. It's what she would have wanted."
Somehow, this knowledge only made the tears fall faster. He was glad they were hidden beneath his mask, though they made the cloth cling to his cheeks. His aunt hated him, there was no doubt about that, and yet she was all he had.
"Why am I like this?"
he asked.
"Why me?"
The woman's voice softened for a rare moment.
"Only the gods know. Now back to bed, and don't let me hear you making a ruckus again."
She made a shooing motion, but didn't actually touch him. She never touched him, despite the thick folds of cloth that protected her from his skin.
"My skin,"
he thought as he scrambled back into bed, leaving the sweat-damp sheets on the floor.
"My curse. My weapon."
The lantern bobbed away, and darkness returned. Chavos longed to feel a hand on his face, arms around him, holding him, protecting him.
"I'm not the one who needs protecting,"
he reminded himself.
"Everyone else needs protection from me."
Chavos was born with a strange marking, a tatuya, as they were called in the south. Though his aunt had only let him see it once before, illuminated by torchlight, the image was burned into his memory. Three broken circles joined together in the center, a fourth broken circle spinning between them.
"The plague mark. I am death. I am poison. I am a murderer."
He blinked away more tears and tried to sleep. Eventually he drifted off, and even his dreams were afraid of him, keeping their distance as he slumbered. 2 years later, circa 524, Chavos peered through a crack between the shutters. It was the best he could do. The wooden shutters covered all but a tiny strip of the dirt-streaked glass window, nailed firmly around the frame. Children laughed, playing in a dusty field. He watched them often as they ran, kicking a worn leather sack back and forth. It was some sort of a team game, though Chavos had never been able to participate in such a thing. His games were all solitary ones. Now he longed to join these children. Most of them were dark-skinned, like his mother had been, like his aunt was. They looked like Calypsians. He, on the other hand, was eerily pale, which should have been impossible given his mother's brown skin and his father's even darker skin. Or so his aunt told him. He'd never actually seen either of them. His father had left before he was born, apparently, and never returned. A smart move, all things considered. Chavos stuck his eye further into the crack, trying to see more of the sand field, more of the children. He watched them often, and though he didn't know their names, he knew them by the way they ran. "Wind," he called a girl who was about his own age, a fleet-footed player who often scored for her team. Her long, dark hair trailed behind her like shadowy tendrils as she raced for the sack. Chavos's breath caught in his lungs as he watched another player cutting in from the side. "Rockhead," he'd named this one, an older boy with a big old head who liked to throw his weight around. Wind didn't see him coming, her focus entirely on the leather sack. Chavos wanted to warn her, to shout something, but his voice stuck in his throat and it wouldn't have mattered anyway, because he was too far away for her to hear him.
The collision was violent, and Wind, who was in an awkward position, got the worst of it, flying through the air and crumpling to the hard ground, her leg bent awkwardly behind her. Chavos watched as she writhed in pain, and he knew her bones were broken.
She might never run, or even walk, again.
He backed away from the shattered window, the thought of the injured girl making him unbearably sad.
"She needs help," he thought,
suddenly feeling full of energy. He charged for the door, which was locked and barred from the outside, a precaution his aunt never failed to forget when she left their house.
"I can break through it," he thought, determination coursing through him.
He picked up a wooden chair awkwardly, trying to raise it over his head so he could crash it into the door. His thin arms wobbled, and the chair tilted and his legs gave out.
"Oof!"
he grunted, as the chair landed atop him, cracking his jaw through his face mask. He lay there for a while, his face throbbing. The pain, however, wasn't nearly as bad as the realization that he was useless, purposeless. Stuck inside all day, every day, he had no real reason for living. He pushed the chair off, cringing as two of the legs went in opposite directions, having shattered in half when he fell. His aunt wasn't going to be pleased.
"Who cares?"
he thought.
"A broken chair is nothing compared to that poor girl's broken bones. The girl. Wind."
Remembering her, he rushed back to the crack in the shutters to see what was happening. He gasped. The girl was walking away, toward one of the neighbouring houses, flanked by two boys and a man. The man was large, a grey-skinned dreadnoughter who Chavos had seen many times through the window. One of the boys was another player that he also recognized, dark-skinned in the typical Calypsian manner. The second boy, however, had wavy blonde hair and light skin. Wisps of bright light seemed to rise from his chest, but were quickly fading. And then the light blinked out and they were gone, disappearing inside another house. As expected, Chavis's aunt was not happy about the chair.
"This will cost me a week's worth of dragons to repair," she shouted, each hand holding one of the shattered chair legs.
"It's just a chair," Chavos said,
thinking of the girl's broken leg.
"It's not broken any more," he thought. "Somehow she was healed."
Regardless, it was the wrong thing to say to his aunt, because the chair legs were still very much broken. With a snap of her wrist, she threw one at him. It hit him square in the chest, bouncing off and rattling across the floor.
"Just a chair? This was your mother's favourite chair, crafted by one of the best woodworkers in the city. Is it still just a chair?"
"I..."
The thought of his mother should have sent a pang of sadness through him, but instead he felt nothing. The truth was, he didn't even know his mother. And when she died, when his condition had killed her, he was a newborn babe, as unaware of what was happening as a raindrop was of splashing into a puddle.
"Yes, it's still just a chair."
"You little wretch,"
his aunt growled, stalking toward him. She raised the other chair leg threateningly, and then swung it, aiming for his shoulder. He acted on instinct, thrusting his arm out. The wooden stick stopped. He stared at his gloved hand, which had caught his aunt's hand, preventing her from completing the blow. He could feel the warmth of her skin through the glove.
No, wait.
It was more than that. He could feel her skin against his. It felt
wonderful.
And terrible.
"Oh, gods!"
she murmured, pulling back sharply, her eyes flicking from her hand to his.
"What have you done?"
For a moment, Chavos was confused, but then he noticed a sliver of pale skin shining from a tear in his glove. He stared at it, mesmerized by the look of his own flesh, the way it resembled the crack in the shutters when sunlight shone through the window in the morning. His aunt backed further away, a strangled groan rising from deep in her throat.
"First your mother, and now me. You're a demon, boy. A demon!"
He was a boulder, and her words were pebbles.
"It's not my fault I was born this way,"
he thought, as he stepped around her. He left, never returning to see what had happened to her, though rumours of a great plague raging through the city sprung up a few days later. Only they weren't rumours. 5 years later, circa 529, he no longer thought of himself as Chavos. No, that person had died along with his aunt. The Calypsians had given him many names, but his favourite was the Beggar, so that's what he called himself. Of course, no one really knew who he was. That was another effect of his tattooia. He could float through the city and barely be noticed, even garbed in his strange attire, long cloak, face mask, gloves, tall boots. And those who did notice him couldn't seem to recall him afterwards, not his appearance or the way he walked or anything. "I am a ghost. I am a beggar. Unnoticed. Unwanted. Unimportant." The plague had torn through Caleb for 4 long years, reaching as far as the citadel. Though it was his aunt who had apparently left their home shortly after he had, and run through the city ranting and grabbing people, infecting them. The beggar took responsibility for each and every one of their deaths, which numbered in the hundreds, if not thousands. Empress Riza Sands, named after the city of the rising sun, had perished a year into the plague. Her eldest daughter, Sun, had won the empire 4 years ago, defeating both of her sisters, Wendy and Viper, in hand-to-hand combat in the arena. "I am the beggar. I am a murderer." And then, as swiftly as the plague had arose, it vanished. Those quarantined had been sent to an uninhabited island in Dragon Bay, left to eventually succumb to the disease. In the last year, talk of the plague had dwindled, though he still heard his various nicknames mentioned in idle gossip, many people claiming to have seen him in alleyways, lurking in the shadows. Since his aunt's death, the beggar had not had skin-to-skin contact with another human being. He didn't know if it was luck or careful practice, or a function of the ethereal manner in which he could pass through the city unnoticed. Regardless, he was glad for it. Sitting with his back against the wall, sweating beneath his thick clothing, the beggar thought about all the deaths he'd caused, people he'd never met, strangers. In some ways, that felt worse than what he'd done to his aunt, to his mother. "I don't want to kill again. Never again. Please, gods. Please let me just live. Why?" The question came out of nowhere, as it often did, pounding through his head like a slow drumbeat. "Why? Why? 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 Why do I want to live?" Though he hated to admit it, he had hope for himself. It felt selfish, this hope, considering all the pain and suffering he had caused. And yet he clung to it like a beetle to a palm frond under the onslaught of a summer storm. Hiding in plain sight, he listened to the stories told in alehouses and marketplaces and on the streets of Calypso. Tales of the tattooia bearers, Southron gods in human form who had come to save them all, to help them win the civil war with Fanes, and then the whole of the Four Kingdoms. Even the Empress's second oldest daughter, Fire, bore a tattooia, the Firemark. She was loved by her people because of it. They thought she would be their saviour when she came of age. When the beggar heard those stories, he felt connected to the other marked people. "Can I be like them? Can I do something good with my curse?" In those moments, he felt the opposite of the way he'd felt on the day he'd infected his aunt. He felt like he had a purpose, a reason for living. He felt hope, like a flame burning inside his chest. "I have a role to play in this world," he thought. He wanted it to be the truth more than anything else. Someone flicked a coin into the small leather box he'd set before him when he sat down. It clinked amongst a handful of other coins he'd received so far. They were mostly coppers, but still. "Thank you," he murmured automatically, still lost in his thoughts. Strong hands grabbed him, pulling him upwards, slamming him against the wall, causing stars to burst across his vision. The smell of smoke and onions assaulted his nostrils as hot breath splashed across his mask, brushing his exposed lips.
"Don't fight it, and this will all go easier,"
his attacker hissed. He heard the jingle of coins as someone else presumably scooped up his leather box and made off with it. The hands released him, and he fell, collapsing to his knees. He blinked, trying to restore his vision. He squinted as light poured in, obliterating the stars. As expected, his coins were gone. He scanned the street, but the thieves had disappeared. Several sets of eyes were focused in his direction, but the people seemed confused, as if they weren't quite sure what they were seeing. He didn't know what he looked like to them, exactly. A smudge of grey against the tan stones, perhaps? A shadow in a place where there shouldn't be one? It didn't matter. They wouldn't remember any details about him. Something felt strange, however. He felt cool. The wind was blowing, yes, but usually that didn't help him much, due to his thick clothing and face mask. And yet, the skin on each side of his chest felt cooler as the sweat seemed to dry. The coolness seemed to originate from the exact places where the attacker's strong hands had grabbed him, the man's fingers poking into his flesh.
Oh, no. Oh, no, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no!
He looked down. A wail tore from his throat when he saw the holes torn in his shirt, twin spots of pale flesh staring out at him. The plague had returned to Calypso. 3 years later, circa 532, countless people had died because of him, were still dying. Each time the beggar's heart pulsed in his chest, he wondered whether someone else had died. Though plague victims continued to be quarantined on Dragon's Breath, the Empire's efforts had done little to stem the spread of the disease. The beggar woke up each morning and found a looking-glass or a puddle or a water trough, forcing himself to stare at his own reflection. And each day he made a choice not to kill himself. He wasn't sure why, exactly, only that his tattooia would pulse from his skin, staying his hand. One day the sun was shining brightly. The beggar was on the move, heading for a part of Calypso he hadn't been to in a while, hoping for a change of scenery. As he approached a main thoroughfare from the safety of an alleyway, the trio of pyramids rose up in the distance, towering over the sandstone dwellings most citizens lived in. A royal cavalcade was moving through the centre of the street, pushing the crowds to the dust-piled edges of the buildings. Several of the horsemen steered their steeds precariously close to the crowd, and the onlookers were forced to jump back. One of them was too slow, nearly getting himself trampled, falling backward in a cloud of dust. Unlike most people in the crowd, he was light-featured and looked out of place amongst the Calypsians. There was something familiar about the man, who wasn't much older than the beggar. The man turned, coughing out a wad of brown spit. The beggar froze. Him. The blonde-haired boy from the dusty field that day, all those years ago. The one with the girl who shouldn't have been able to walk. The one who had wisps of light trailing from his chest. Though the beggar hadn't thought of that day in many years, the memory of it was as vivid as a spark in the dark. It was the day he'd accidentally killed his aunt and released the plague. Yes, he was certain it was the same boy, though he'd grown up a lot since then, as had the beggar. Somehow, over time and distance, he still felt inexplicably connected to this man, though he'd never met him before in his life. This feeling spurred him forward. With each step, he felt as if his fate was finally calling him. Or at least part of his fate. For the first time in his life, he knew he was in the right place at the exact right time. "This is why I'm not dead," he thought. He approached the boy from behind. "Are you injured?" he asked. His voice, which hadn't been used in a long time, sounded like that of a stranger to his own ears. The man said he was not, raising an eyebrow as he took in the beggar's odd appearance. "Wait, he can see me. He can really see me. Not like the others." The realization seemed to validate his purpose for being here. He knew what to do. He extended his hand to help him up. After a brief pause, the man accepted his assistance and allowed the beggar to pull him to his feet. There was a brief and awkward exchange of pointless pleasantries, in which the beggar refused to give his name, and then the man said, "I'm Roan." "You can see me? Please, please, please." Roan squinted, and it was clear he thought he was dealing with someone who'd lost their mind. But that didn't matter,
didn't matter, because, yes, I can see you. The faintest streak of light zipped from Roan's chest, and the beggar smiled beneath his hood. I'm not alone, he thought.
Postlude 3. Heinrich Gehrig. Somewhere north of the Mournful Mountains, circa 10. When, after 3 long years at sea, Captain Heinrich Gehrig had arrived on the shores of this new land a decade earlier, he'd been full of excitement and anticipation. That day had been warm and sunny, the salty breeze blowing gentle waves against the rocky embankment, a new world to explore. Now he felt nothing but cold. Not the cold of an icy winter in northern Crimea, he'd experienced several of those, but a cold that seemed to burrow into his bones, taking up residence. On this frozen tundra next to an enormous ice-sheathed body of water they'd appropriately named Frozen Lake, Heinrich wondered whether he'd ever feel warm again. "We should turn back," Austed said, staring out into the blizzard from the large command tent they'd erected just before the storm had moved in. Austed was a grizzled veteran explorer with pockmarked cheeks and perpetually chapped lips. He was also Heinrich's right-hand man, whose advice he didn't take lightly. Over more than 30 years of expeditions together, they'd seen things other men could only dream of, places that were untouched by human feet, unseen by human eyes. This was, possibly, one of those very places. And Heinrich was not the kind of man to give up easily. No, he was the appointed explorer for King Peter Strait, ruler of Crimea and conqueror of the world. Heinrich had a duty to uphold and a reputation to maintain.
"Gather the men," he said. "I have an announcement to make."
After Heinrich's decision had been announced, he lounged in his tent, trying to sleep. A rustle outside drew his attention, just as his eyes were closing.
"I'm awake," he growled,
so the visitor wouldn't feel uncomfortable having to wake him.
"It's me," a voice said. It was the voice of his only son, Thomas, a strong lad and solid seaman of 18.
Over the last decade and the 3 years at sea preceding it, Thomas had grown up, while his mother had died of scurvy during the voyage. Though it had been a difficult time for both of them, it hadn't doused the fire for adventure that always seemed to glow inside the boy.
"He's too much like me," Heinrich often mused. "Come in."
The thick, triple-skinned tent flap fluttered and then pushed inward, releasing a torrent of icy air and a flurry of snowflakes inside. Thomas dove in and fought the tent for a moment before resealing it, cutting off the cold air. He turned to his father, holding a lantern to the side, careful not to shine it in the expedition leader's eyes.
"I won't leave," the boy said.
Heinrich sighed. He had expected this.
"You don't have a choice."
"Because you're my father."
"No, because I'm your commander, appointed by the king himself."
Thomas set the lantern down and waved his hands from side to side.
"What king? I don't see any king in these lands. All I see is you, the true leader of the colonies. You delivered us here. You conquered these lands. The king might as well be somewhere on one of the moons."
Heinrich tried not to laugh, despite the treasonous tone to his son's words. This side of him came from his mother, and he'd heard her speak similar words on a dozen other expeditions over the years. She'd wanted him to settle down somewhere and start a family, forget about the king and his lust for land and war. They'd compromised, and he'd given her a son while discovering a chain of uninhabited tropical islands in the southern Crimean Sea. That was 18 years ago, however, a lifetime ago. And this was now, and he needed to stop this kind of talk before it got his son into trouble. Rather than a stiff rebuke, he chose humour as his sword of rebuttal.
"I'll send a message to the king informing him of your position."
His son was not amused, his broad Gehrig jaw stiffening.
"It's not funny, father."
"You're right. Talk of treason is in no way funny."
"It's not treason, it's reality."
"You want to claim independence from the crown?"
"Not today, but someday, yes. This land is too large to be governed from across the sea. King Strait must be made to understand that."
Heinrich closed his eyes.
opened them.
"You know I don't care about any of that. All I want is to explore."
"But not with me," Thomas said, sulking now. It was a stark reminder that though his son had the rugged build of a man grown now, he still had a lot of maturing to do. The truth was, Heinrich had been willing to drag his family with him on a lot of dangerous voyages, because it was simply too hard to be away from them so much of the time. His own selfishness had cost him his wife, the mother of his son, the love of his life. His love for exploration had taken precedence over the safety of his own family. Not any more. Continuing north through the blizzard was simply too dangerous, and he wouldn't risk his son's life. But he couldn't tell him that. Not only would it only make Thomas more adamant about staying with the expedition, but it would make him feel like a child, something he wasn't willing to do, not when his son had proven his mettle time and time again over the last few years. No, a different tact would be necessary to convince his son to leave and return to the first city they'd established in these lands, the burgeoning colony known as Night's End.
"You are my only heir, Thomas," he said. "If you are serious about one day seeking independence for the colonies, then at least one of us must survive, and it needs to be you. My heart is simply not in it the way yours is."
Thomas raised his eyebrows, surprised. It was clearly not the response he had expected. And though it wasn't a lie exactly, it also wasn't the full truth.
"I have to protect you from my own stupidity."
"Fine. I'll lead half of the exploration party back to Night's End as you commanded, Father. But I won't wait for you there. New ships bearing colonists arrive every fortnight, and we need to push southward and build new colonies to accommodate them all. With your blessing and authority, I will lead them."
"You have my authority," Heinrich said. "At least it will be warmer there. Tell them we have gone to explore the northern hinterlands."
"I will." They clasped hands, and then Thomas slipped away, back into the cold, dark night. Thomas and his men left early the next day, before Heinrich had awoken. "Till we meet again," he thought. The remaining company pushed northward, along the western edge of Frozen Lake, the going getting slower and slower as the drifts of snow grew thicker and thicker. Snow fell like torrential rain, whipping against their faces, blinding them. The cold seeped through scarf and cloak, soaking them to the skin. If they didn't die from exhaustion, they would almost certainly die from exposure if the storm didn't abate. Still, Heinrich dared not adjust his path to the ice-covered body of water, though a number of his men continued to eye the lake hungrily.
"This is madness,"
Austed eventually said, when they were forced to halt completely. The snow was up to their waists now, and pushing through it was nearly impossible.
"I have followed you through gnarled jungles and across vast oceans. Together we have conquered burnt deserts and scaled steep cliffs. Never have I questioned your judgment. But now I must, for this place isn't meant for exploration. What do you hope to discover? There is nothing here but ice and snow. It is a frozen hell we find ourselves in, and I fear if we continue there shall be no return."
"Thank you for your counsel," Heinrich said.
"But you won't turn back?"
"No."
Austed shook his head. The rest of the men were digging furrows in the snow, trying to make space to erect their tents and escape the daggers of wind slashing in from all sides.
"Will you defy my command?" Heinrich said. "I am your captain." "I'm not speaking to my captain right now," Austed said, squinting as blustery snow pelted his face.
Heinrich frowned, not understanding.
"I'm speaking to my friend," Austed said, explaining. "No, Captain, I won't defy your command, even if it means my death and yours. But I will never fail to speak my mind."
With that, he turned away, disappearing into the snowy whiteness, joining the rest of the men in setting up camp. Heinrich was no dictator. Yes, he expected his orders to be followed, but only because anything else would incite mutiny. But he'd listened to counsel in the past, even when he wasn't certain he agreed with it. Plus, Austed, his closest friend and ally, had made good points. Logical points.
What do I hope to discover in this frozen wasteland?
He tried to consider the situation without emotion, without his lust for discovery, his insatiable need to go where no man had ever set foot before. Tucked in the relative warmth of his tent, safe from the wind and snow, which now provided a reasonable measure of insulation, Heinrich's head felt clearer. South of Frozen Lake, the land was inhabitable, there was no questioning that. They could set up several large colonies, including one nestled just below the lake, pumping an endless supply of fresh water from beneath the icy surface. But here, this far north, no one could survive. Could they? And even if they could, what kind of life would they live?
A cold one, Heinrich mused.
But still, there must be something worth finding to the north, right? Something of value? Gold, perhaps? Heinrich didn't care for riches. He wasn't a treasure hunter by any stretch of the imagination. But at least discovering gold or other precious metals would justify this expedition, as well as keep the king happy.
The king, he thought.
Was his son right? Was it inevitable that this enormous land sever itself from Crimea's influence? King Strait was an arrogant man who believed the entirety of the world, both land and sea, was his to be conquered, ruled by his iron fist. He wouldn't bow to a bunch of revolutionaries, not without a fight, not without bloodshed. Once Heinrich returned to Night's End, he would have to try to convince Thomas that they needed the resources and support of the Crimean crown. The last thing Heinrich wanted was a drawn-out war. He was no soldier, after all. Nor visionary. Thus far, this decade-long endeavour had been largely uncontested, though scouts had returned to the west with news of strange-looking natives inhabiting both the east and south. Barbarians, they called them. Heathens. Heinrich didn't like such labels.
Just because people are different doesn't make them the enemy.
He'd learned that too many times before. His thoughts were diverging from the matter at hand, he realized, and he steered them back to the decision he had to make. Keep going in search of the great unknown, or admit defeat and turn back. He drifted off to sleep, hoping the right answer would reveal itself in the morning. Heinrich stretched and yawned, awakening to the sound of men laughing and talking. It was a familiar sound, and yet one that was completely unexpected. There was no howling wind, no flapping canvas. He poked his head into a morning that was cold, but not nearly as cold as the days previous. Smoke from several cook fires curled lazily into the sky, wisps of grey against an otherwise white backdrop. The wind had abated, the storm moving on to torment another part of the land. White, powdery drifts were piled up against empty tents. Pockets of men sat around the fires, which were crackling merrily. The whole setup had a surreal feel to it, as if Heinrich was still asleep in some dream world.
"This is my answer," he thought.
Not because the way had suddenly gotten easier, but because this was something new, something he'd never experienced before, something to excite him. He scooted out of the tent and rose. Heads turned his way, watching his approach. Cut in half, his company looked small, only 40 men remaining. The toughest of the tough, those he'd known the longest. Ousted's steely eyes met his, and his friend nodded.
"He thinks I'm going to announce our retreat," he thought.
He cleared his throat.
"The way forward is a risk. I'd be lying if I said otherwise," he started. "And I won't force any man to accompany me from this point onward. But I am also not broken, not defeated, not content to leave the mysteries of our world unsolved. This is what I do, explore, and if I stop now I might as well let you plant me in the ground. Who is with me?"
A moment of silence ensued, and Heinrich noticed several eyes flick to Ousted, as if looking for a cue from him.
"He has the ears of the men," Heinrich thought. "He could mutiny if he wants to."
But then Ousted said,
"I am, but I'm not trudging through any more of this hell-frozen snow."
Heinrich couldn't hold back his laugh, and neither could the other men, who merrily agreed to continue north.
"Good," Heinrich said. because this won't mean the same thing without my friends by my side. And there won't be any more trudging. If we're going to risk our lives, we might as well do so sliding across the ice."
Ousted nodded, and handed Heinrich a tin plate loaded with charred meat and boiled potatoes.
"Plan of attack? Any small